Coming up on Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway, we talk with Laura Benanti. We also review Most Happy Fella at Goodspeed, Betrayal, After Midnight, Becoming Dr. Ruth, The Landing, and Disaster, a 1970s disaster movie musical. Please stay tuned. Love strangers.
You want to kiss the man at the post office or the woman at the dry cleaners? Or you just want to wrap your arms around life, life itself, but you can't. And this feeling wells up, and there's nowhere to put this great happiness. And then you're floating, and then you're falling, and then you just become unbearably sad. And you have to go lie down on the couch.
Are you still in therapy?
That's funny. Everybody's always asking me, Tilly, are you still in therapy? I say something like, I've had a bad day. And they say, Tilly, are you still in therapy? I go to therapy and my therapist falls in love with me. I have to be careful.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, November 3rd, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Kenneth Jones and Michael Portantier. Kenneth is a New York City theater journalist and dramatist who was a theater critic and reporter for the Detroit News for a decade before he became a leading writer and editor at Playbill.com for 15 years. His work appeared at Backstage, TDF, Stages, and many other places. He now blogs on his own site, bykennethjones.com, when he's not working on his own plays and musicals. Hi, Kenneth. How are you?
Hey, James.
You're stepping in for Peter Felicia, who is away this week. Thanks so much.
I'm playing the role of Peter Felicia.
Excellent. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hi, I haven't decided whose role I'm playing today, but we'll figure it out.
In the role of Michael Portantier is Michael Portantier. With us this morning, we have a special guest. Laura Benanti is with
Perfectly said.
You know, and we practiced that before we actually went on. So
For like 45 minutes.
Exactly. And it is daylight savings time. So it's almost like we have 15 minutes extra to keep working on that.
Oh, thank God.
So Laura, we know from many, many a Broadway show, starting with The Sound of Music and then heading into Swing and Into the Woods and Something Good and Nine and The Wedding Singer and Gypsy and The Next Room and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And it seems like we're starting back again at The Sound of Music, aren't we?
I know. It's so crazy. It's so full circle.
Of course, it's not the Broadway production, but NBC, is it NBC? It's NBC, isn't it?
It's NBC. It's a live televised event for NBC on December 5th, and it is not a remake of the movie. Let me be clear, because no one can remake that movie, and ain't nobody going to be Julie Andrews, but Julie Andrews.
And so who are you playing on the movie?
It's basically the televised version of the stage play. Uh-huh. And I play Elsa Schrader or Schroeder. I don't know how to pronounce her name yet.
Schrader, who in the show has two songs and in the movie has none.
Exactly. But we're going to have the two songs. Christian Borle is playing Max. And so they put back in No Way to Stop It and
How Can Love Survive?
How Can Love Survive? Thank you. I love that I am clearly so on top of it that I don't even know the name of the song that I'm
maybe,
singing.
You know,
so
what's your take
on Elsa? Super professional.
What should she be like?
What should Elsa be like?
Yeah.
Well, I have discussed with Rob Ashford that I feel like Elsa should always be like half a martini in. I feel like she should always just be, you know, like when you have half a martini and you're just like warm and fuzzy, everything is just like great. I want her to feel that way all the time, where she's just like self-medicating basically throughout the entire journey in order to deal with the children. She's like, ooh, I'm going to have another martini if I'm going to have to play with these children because there's seven of them.
When you played Maria at, was it 19?
Well, I was 18 when I first played Maria and when Rebecca Luker went on vacation for 2 weeks. And then I was 19 when I officially took over the role.
Was Jan Maxwell still in the show at that point?
Yes.
Because she sort of played it. I mean, she may not have had a martini in her hand, but she sort of played it like, you know, that kind of woman.
Let's be honest, you guys. I'm just going to steal shamelessly from Jen Maxwell. Obviously. I mean, why wouldn't I? I'm not a monster. The woman is a genius, and I got to listen to her for like a year and a half. I'm taking everything that I can. I've already told her that. She knows.
Oh, Laura, good. You know, it is Halloween weekend, and mm-hmm. We mentioned it, daylight savings times already, and all that other stuff. But I noticed that you had a little Twitter back and forth with Andrew Reynolds.
God, I love
about,
him so much.
About trick or treating with martinis.
Yes.
And so, is this a theme with you, martinis on the weekend?
I don't know what you're talking about. You have no proof of any of these things, and I will not be slandered this way on the radio. You'll be hearing from my lawyer.
Excellent.
As soon as I get a lawyer. So,
isn't Andrew Reynolds your lawyer?
Andrew Reynolds is my lawyer, which is great. Because I think he has a BFA, so that should be perfect. He should be a wonderful lawyer.
Excellent. So also, aside from your NBC ventures, you have just released your new CD. So why don't you tell us about that?
I have a live album that was recorded at 54 Below. It's called In Constant Search of the Right Kind of Attention. And it's just basically my live show that was done in May. And I'm really proud of it. We kept in the in-between song banter.
Which is so hilarious. I love when you talk.
Thank you.
Can you talk about a little bit about the Soprano Museum and
Soprano Isle? Well, yeah. I really do feel like even in the musical theater where it used to be safe to be a soprano, even in musical theater now, it's just there's no safe place to be a soprano anymore. I just feel like there's just going to be like a museum where it's just. And I say this in the album, where it's just going to be like a hologram of Barbara Cook singing a high C. You can go and watch and then leave, pay your $5. So I talk a little bit about Soprano Island, where like me and Kelly O'Hara and Audra McDonald and Kristen Chenoweth and Melissa Errico, where we're going to all have to go live. And then I actually expanded upon it, which you can't hear on the album. But I like the idea that maybe it's like a Survivor-style television show for Bravo. Mm. And there's only one dresser. Who gets her? Who gets the dresser? I don't know. You have to watch. You're welcome, Bravo.
That would be pretty. That could get pretty ugly.
I mean, yeah.
But, you know, you do make the point in your patter that, and it's true, I the only person I can think of offhand, really, who was a very famous soprano in the pop field was Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I sang her a song on my album.
Yeah.
I think he comes for conversation. But Kate Bush was a soprano, is a soprano. Tori Amos is a soprano. You know, there are some sopranos.
Yeah, Minnie Riperton.
Yeah.
I have no idea who that is.
I have no idea who that is. But I find even in musical theater now, it's like everything is pop music. And I love pop music. I really do. But I feel like there has to be a place for a classic soprano. I like listening to it.
Laura, what was it like putting the evening together? I assume when you sat down with Todd Allman, you had a list of 100 songs or, you know, more.
No, I'm the worst. I approach every single venture I go into with this attitude. Well, this is never going to work. That's how I like to start every new adventure in my life. Well, this is going to be a nightmare. So I came in with like 2 songs and a terrible attitude. And I was like, I don't even know what to do. But Todd is a genius and one of my closest friends in the entire world. And we basically were like, what is the story that we're trying to tell? And when you buy the album, you'll realize no story. I just want to sing songs and make an idiot as myself. But we did want it to feel, and I always feel this way with my shows, I never want it to feel stuffy. I don't want it to feel like you're going back in time. Mm. I want it to feel like something new and fresh. And, you know, I'm happy to say that so many people who come to my shows are teenagers, are young people. And makes me feel excited for the future of live theater because sometimes I get a little bit nervous about it.
Now, given what you've just said, I imagine you, your album is one of a series of terrific live albums from 54 Below.
Yeah.
I assume you, did you enjoy doing a live album?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, look, I killed two birds with one stone. All I did was my live show, and then someone made an album. So, yeah, I loved it.
But it's I meant in terms of the spontaneity and the audience response and all
that. Oh, yeah. I think it's really nice to, you know, hear an audience response. And I don't know, I've always loved live albums because you feel like you're included in the evening somehow, which I think is exciting.
Right.
So I was happy to do it. And now Todd and I are talking about doing a studio album together. That would be a different thing altogether. But I've really enjoyed doing the live album. I just think that they do such a wonderful job.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's hard to believe that this is your first solo album. I didn't know that.
No, yeah.
Had you been reluctant to do studio stuff, or did the opportunity just...
No, I just couldn't figure out what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, I just, like, honestly couldn't... I didn't know if I wanted it to be my music that I wrote, or if I wanted it to be, like, a big symphony, or if I wanted it to be jazzy, or... I did not know what I wanted it to be.
You only had two songs and a bad attitude.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, that should be my my memoir. Two songs and a bad attitude.
Or the title
of my gravestone. Either one.
Title of the next album.
Yeah, exactly.
And your relationship with Todd Allman, he's so brilliant. Oh. The arrangements are so incredibly fresh and confident. What is it about you guys? How did you meet, and what's with your chemistry?
We met years and years ago, I think through Ted Sperling, who said, you two should meet each other. You have a really similar musical sensibility. And I fell in love with him and his music. And I've done a bunch of readings of his pieces and recordings for him. And I did The Tempest in the Park that he wrote and starred in, which was so magnificent. Mm. I just think that he is a really fresh voice and a wonderful person. He's a remarkable human being, so he's fun to be around. And he loves musical theater as I do, but he also loves, you know, Tor Amos as I do. So he has we just have a similar way of approaching songs.
And he's a composer, of course, too.
He is. He's a brilliant composer. I sing two of his songs on the album.
Yeah.
The album includes the introductions, and it also includes a recording of your friend Patti LuPone telling people to turn off their cell phones, but oddly enough, not telling them not to take pictures.
I know. Well, yeah. We figure that they have to know that by now. But actually, the one that we ended up using in the second time around when I did it,
yes,
was one of her saying, turn your effing phones off. So it got a little bit more R-rated.
I noticed that you wrote a song on there as well, the ukulele song.
I wrote two songs, the ukulele song and then a song called New Mexico.
Oh, so is this some place that we might see you venture into seeing your credits elsewhere on a Broadway show?
No, I will never. I'm not good enough of a songwriter, period, but especially not to write.
When you sit down to write a Broadway show, all you could just say is, oh, this will never work.
Yeah, perfect. That'll be the title of it. This will never work. It'll be just me complaining the whole time.
You could be accepting the Tony Award, and you're like, oh, this will never work. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, guys, that's my solution to all things.
And it's only two songs.
Boom. I think we really discovered something here.
A bad attitude.
It's the micro musical. There it is.
The micro musical. Oh, I actually do like that.
The micro musical. There we are. And I noticed that you ventured off into Harry Chapin land as well as you talked
about. I love Harry Chapin. Yes. I have loved him for so long, since I was a little girl. For me, all of his songs were like little mini plays. You know, they're like, some of them are 6, 7, 8 minutes long, and they're storytelling. He tells a story. They're like mini movies.
The Taxi Driver.
Oh, the best. Better Place to Be.
Yeah. Oh.
Mail Order Annie. Hmm. I mean, so many wonderful songs. So I will hopefully sing his music forever.
You talked about in the recording, you talked about your history of loving musical theater growing up. And, and you know, tell us some more about that and how you made the jump over the Hudson River.
Well, my mom and my dad, Marty, were both performers. And then my mom became a voice teacher and then got remarried to my dad, Sal, and we moved to New Jersey. But I always knew, I mean, from the time that I can remember, I always knew that I wanted to be on Broadway. I didn't want to be a movie star. I didn't want to be Julie Roberts. I wanted to be Julie Andrews. And so I focused my my mind toward that. I took all of my community theater productions and high school productions very seriously. Mm. Ask anyone who was in any of those productions mm-hmm. with me.
I know a handful of them, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, oh, yeah, that girl was a lot. and then when I was 16 years old, I won the Paper Mill Playhouse Rising Star Award for my portrayal of Dolly Levi in Hello, Dolly, up the octave. I'm going to raise the roof. I'm going to carry on in the Patrice Menzel key. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are true stories, you guys. And so I won their very first award, and then they put me in two of their shows back to back. I got my equity card. And then when Sound of Music was happening on Broadway, they recommended that I audition for Liesel. So I went in, auditioned for Jay Binder for Liesel, and he saw me. I mean, the fact that the man was like, I think I'm going to bring this 17-year-old kid in front of producers to understudy Maria. It was very brave of him, I think. and it all worked out. It's a very unusual story. You know, kids always ask me, like, how did you get involved in the business? And I almost hesitate to say it because I don't want anyone to think that that's how it goes. Mm. You know, I was so unbelievably lucky the way that those things worked out. And I worked hard as well, but a lot of it truly was luck.
I believe you aren't the only amazing person to come out of the Paper Mill.
Oh my gosh, Anne Hathaway.
Yes.
And you know, so many
several
incredible
others. Yeah.
It's true. Jersey Strong.
And growing up, were you the kid listening to show albums, to cast albums all the time, or did you mix between? Like, what's like the album that you wore out?
Well, look, let's be honest. I didn't have the greatest taste at times. I was obsessed with Stephen Sondheim, so I listened to all Sondheim. But then I also ran around my room to Cats and to, you know, Phantom of the Opera. But I would sing The Phantom.
You had the concept album of Starlight Express?
I did not, but I did
with El DeBarge?
I did not have that. But I did have... Oh gosh! Well, a tape of a British show called The Hired Man.
Hired Man. Oh yeah.
The Hired Man, and I used to sing it all the time. Oh God! Even my friends who love musical theater were like, "That's too far out there. Get out of here."
What's that song in there? I wouldn't.
Oh, to be a hired man.
I wouldn't be the first, nor would I be the last.
Yes.
You're
speaking my language now. But also I wasn't to, you know, I wanted to have some friends. So then I ended up like, I ended up listening to like Tori Amos and Pearl Jam and like all of the grungy music of the '90s. But what I would do basically is I would like
American Idiot. Yeah.
Well, no, that was like a little after I'm a little bit older than that.
Yeah. But we still think of you as very, very young. Remember?
Which is why I'm talking to you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So tell us, what is coming up with you after NBC? What's in the hopper?
One of the most amazing things that I am so excited. I can't even think about it. It's The Most Happy Fella.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited about The Most Happy Fella. Right now I'm doing double duty, though. I'm doing Sound of Music, and I have a recurring part on Nurse Jackie.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And then there's actually another thing that I can't talk about yet, but I'm getting very, very excited about that will be before Most Happy Fella. And then, yeah, Most Happy Fella. And let me tell you how I lobbied for that one, you guys. I had my agents call Jack Fertel, who I've known for 1,000 years, and they were like, these are three shows that Laura would like to do. Is there any possibility that they could be done at Encores? One of them being Most Happy Fella. And he was like, well, ironically, we are doing Most Happy Fella. But she's got to audition. So I went in and I auditioned, which I haven't done for a musical in a while, I'm going to be honest. And I got it. And it was a great feeling. I'd forgotten what that felt like to go in and be super nervous and sing and put yourself out there in that way, in that vulnerable way. And I was very, very relieved to. Oh, and also Shuler texted me. Shuler was like, I know that they're trying to cast Most Happy Fella. And I told them, I think you would be perfect. And I was like, dude, thank you. I'm trying so hard to get this job. So anything you can do to help.
What else, what else is on your short list? What else did you tell Encores you were interested in?
Well, I mean, I would love to do My Fair Lady, but that's, we got to hurry up because I'm going to be 100 years old next year. So what? Yeah, I think Thing, My Fair Lady, and I can't remember the other one.
I keep thinking about roles like Magnolia and Marion the Librarian and Amalia Ballas.
Yeah.
Have you played these? Is this on your list?
I mean, you know what's funny? I don't have a very long list. I've never been like a list maker in that sort of a way. I've just sort of taken, I don't know, I've been more malleable than that, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, I would love to play all of those roles. That would be great.
I remember when I spoke to you some years ago, I think maybe it was during Dream. Swing. Sorry.
Oh, Swing. Oh my God. That was like 12 years ago.
Yeah. Or maybe it was even earlier than that. You said something along the lines of about how your dream was that something along the lines of how you wish the movie musical would come back in a big way. And it's so interesting because that was before, you know, this big resurgence that began with Chicago. So I think I imagine you must be very happy about that.
Well, also, maybe I'm a little psychic. Let's throw that out there.
Yeah, there's that.
Or maybe I manifested it. Yeah, I did want the movie musical to come back, and it has in a big way, and that's very exciting to me.
So I just wanted you to know that there is a very collective angst whenever we see very, very talented people, which I include you in that group, of folks that get TV roles on big networks like Go On and the Playboy Club and things that. And we feel like we're going to lose you forever. But it sounds, when we're talking to you, like we wouldn't lose you really forever.
Never. Never, never, never. Listen, my only goal in life was to be on Broadway. Like, that was it. And if I could do that forever, I absolutely would. And I will occasionally venture into television because I think it's fun and it's interesting to use your brain in a different way. And let's be honest, they pay you.
Yeah.
So I support my Broadway and theater and off-Broadway habit by doing television. But I'm never going to be that person who's like, bye, you guys, it's been fun. Now I'm going to go be a television star. Like, I have no interest in that. And Andrew Rannells is the same way. You know, and Megan Hilty is the same way. And Audra McDonald is the same way. And Kristen Chenoweth is the same way. You know, these are all people who love the theater. And I try to think of myself as an ambassador for musical theater when I go out into Hollywood, because a lot of people don't know anything about theater in a tragically sad way, in my opinion. So if I can be like a conduit, if I can be a bit of a bridge toward people understanding what musical theater is, I'm happy to do that. But yeah, no, I'm never going to like, I'm hoping if you'll have me to always be back to the theater, always.
Well, that's very reassuring. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that you have a handful of concerts coming up in 2014 with the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington, D.C. and the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus.
Yes, I do. I sang with my Uncle Bob, who is no longer with us, was one of the original members of the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington, D.C., and I sang with them about 10 years ago, right before he died, really a few weeks before he passed away. So they are... That particular chorus is very special to me. And then I did I Am Harvey Milk, that Andrew Lippa wrote with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus this past, I guess, was it July or August? I can't remember. So I'm going to go back and sing with them again. And let me tell you, those guys are so talented, but also so fun and sweet and committed. And, you know, the opening night of I Am Harvey Milk was the day that DOMA was repealed. DOMA and Prop 8. So to be on stage with over 300 men who had just been given the civil rights that should have been theirs all along was pretty miraculous. So I'm excited to go back and sing with them again. I'm really excited about it, in fact.
Did I just read that? Wasn't that also recorded?
It's number 2 on iTunes in the classical chart.
Well, that's great.
I know.
Well, so let's wrap up here. If people want to pick up your album or anything like that, they can go to iTunes.
They can go to iTunes and go to Amazon. They can go to my website, laurabonanti.com. That is the brilliant Robbie Rozelle designed. He also designed the cover art for my all the album artwork.
Laura, I don't know if you know this.
What?
I wasn't going to bring it up, but maybe I will.
Okay.
Do you know who owns laurabonanti.com?
Who?
I do.
What? You do?
Yeah, I gave it to Robbie like 10 years ago. As soon as you came on the scene, I said, oh, I have to register that name so she has it.
Oh, that is amazing of you. Wait, so now do you own me? Is that what that means?
Well, I own the name. I do that for a lot of musical theater folks. I've some people drink, some people do drugs. I buy domains.
Well, that seems a much healthier vice.
Yeah, tell my wife. You know, she's like,
yeah.
Why don't we spend $2,000 on domains?
But at least it's not crack.
What I just wanted to say that, you know, it was evident from the very first moment that you stepped on a stage that you were going to be a very big star.
Oh,
you know, Alison Frank, casting director.
Yeah,
Alison has this thing where she says that person came to win. And we just always thought that about you, that you came to win, and we're so excited to see you winning, and that we look forward to all the new things that you're going to be doing. So please stay in touch with us, and I'm sure after Happy Fella comes around, Michael will want to hunt you down again for another interview. Okay.
Yes, please. Absolutely. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me, what you just said, truly.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Well, you have a good rest of the Sunday. Not too many
martinis. No, none. Don't worry.
Okay. And we'll speak to you soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
How lovely to sit here in the shade with none of the woes of man and maid. I'm glad I'm not young anymore. The rivals that don't exist at all, the feeling you're tall. I'm glad that I'm not young anymore. No more.
Well, Laura, isn't she wonderful?
Amazing.
She is.
We're so fortunate to work in a business with such great people in it. So, Ken got a chance to go up to Goodspeed Opera House and see The Most Happy Fella. So, Ken, why don't you tell us about that?
I always love going up to Goodspeed, getting out of the city and sort of blowing the dust off, you know. This production it's a new production of The Most Happy Fella. Of course, Frank Lesser's 1956 musical. Rob Ruggiero directed it. And he's moved the action to the 50s, out of the 20s. It's set in the 20s. And it's sort of, I've never seen a stage production of Happy Fella. I listened to that cast album as a kid and had a Happy Fella in my imagination. So I was sort of not expecting how sort of 50s it was. It's not like they don't do the Charleston. Apparently there's a reference to the Charleston in the script that they've cut, but you know, Lesser's music has that sort of 50s tang to it. Mm. And so it seems to fit very naturally in the 50s. And the sort of world of morality and conformity is sort of very 50s anyway. So it's a very natural fit. It's a really beautiful production, very brisk, beautifully sung, with a lot of performers that I actually haven't seen before. Mamie Paris played Rosabella. Bill Nolte is Tony. Doug Carpenter is Joey. Natalie Hill was Cleo. Kevin Wortman as Herman. And Ann Arvia plays Marie, the sister, Tony's sister. Watching it just reminded me how revolutionary it must have been in 56 to see these show tunes butting up against opera songs. You know, it was as you guys know, it was Lesser's great experiment. And it still feels very, groundbreaking in many ways.
Yeah,
and yet it's still stuck in, not stuck, but it's still very much a golden age show. I was just knocked out by it, and they've interpolated a song called "Eyes Like a Stranger," which I thought was very fresh to this production. But apparently, Joe Lesser, who played the original Rosabella and is Mrs. Frank Lesser, has pushed for this to be interpolated for many years. Since 1979, it's been added. It's a song for Marie, and Arby knocks it out of the park. It's about Tony pulling away from his sister and this sort of breaking her and pushing her forward. And you know, Goodspeed did this two piano version of the show, as you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And I guess it was added then, but it's not on the cast album. They cut, you know, it's a one disc cast album, so they cut that. But it's, there's been a tradition of adding this song, and it's quite dramaturgically brilliant.
There was a TV telecast of the 79 Broadway revival with Giorgio Tutsi, and that had it. And I think that may be available completely on YouTube, that entire performance. At least it was at one point. And it's been, yeah, it's been recorded, and it's been in, I've been lucky enough to see several productions of Happy Fella recently, including two, was it last year or 2 years ago? There was one, at the Da Capo Opera, which had a 30-piece orchestra, which was mind-boggling. And then NYU did it, about 2 months later or earlier, I can't remember now, also with a full orchestra at NYU. And so that was, you know, I mean, I'm so spoiled to hear it. The thought that we're going to hear it again at Encores with Shuler Hensley and Laura Benanti, I think those are the only two who have been announced so far. But whoever else is in it, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. It is a true masterpiece. We've discussed many times before. I think the only reason it's not better known and loved is because it had some bad luck. It opened like right after My Fair Lady. So there was kind of a lot of not as much attention paid to it as would have been otherwise. No movie was ever made of it, which is probably understandable given the style of it and the opera part of it. But if there had been a movie, I think that would have been, that really would have brought it to a whole audience.
I always wonder from a marketing point of view if the title had been different or more specific or more about romance, would the public have caught on? If it was called Somebody Somewhere, does that change the fortunes of it and make it clearly a romance rather than, you know, Happy Fella and Fair Lady? So, you know,
that's interesting. Yeah. And of course, it's based on a play called They Knew What They Wanted, which may also not really just highlight the romance. I mean, that sounds like it could be anything.
That's a murder mystery.
Right. But that's so interesting, Ken, what you said about, I didn't realize that this one was updated to the 50s. Offhand, I can't think of anything in it that really ties it to the 20s. And as you say, the music certainly is nothing like, you know, what you would hear in the 20s.
Yes, and I think in our public imagination also, the pull-out hits from that show, Joey, it was a famous Peggy Lee cover, and Standing on the Corner was done by the Four Freshmen and all those other sort of vocal groups of the 50s. I think it's so very rooted in the 50s.
So that sounds great. Bill Nolte, I wish I could see this production. I don't think I'm going to get there. He's a really great singer, actor, and I think he did the part before right before this, isn't that right?
He's done it for years. He's quite good in it, and he's a wonderful actor and a wonderful singer. It would be interesting to see what Encores chooses to do. I assume that, as is their mission often, that they will do the original Broadway script and score, book, music, and lyrics by Lesser, but there have been some changes over the years, you know, much like Showboat, or much like a lot of shows do get changed by directors with the consent of the estates. For this production, I Made a Fist was cut, the sort of exchange between Cleo and Marie, which is I Don't Like This Dame, has been cut. There's no fist fight at the end between Cleo and Marie, so it'll be interesting to see what choices are made. And my guess is Eyes Like a Stranger will certainly be part of the Encores production, because Lesser himself wanted it, but I gather the producers wanted the cut originally for length.
Right. Without that song, Marie tends to become something of a cipher.
Yes.
Yeah, you really need that song to understand, you know, to make her more sympathetic and understand exactly where she's coming from. And it's so interesting, Ken. I don't know if you know, but there was a tremendous amount of material that was cut at one point or another from the show. And it's a question of, you know, exactly what which of that lesser wanted to be cut and how much was, you know, by he was pressured to cut. But if you get the recording that was made some years ago, that's on Jay Records, it's a complete recording, but then it also has a bonus section of copious material. So anyone who is interested in any of that stuff, you can hear it on that recording. The NYU production, I have to say, they added back, I think, more than was necessary. They added a lot of, quite a bit that's cut from the opening scene. And I just felt like it really kind of delayed it a little more. And, you know, we want to kind of get going into the story and meet Tony, you know. But at any rate, of course, even if it doesn't work in the context of the show, it's Frank Lesser, so it's the kind of stuff you really want to at least listen to it and hear what he had.
And on that Jay Records recording, there is Eyes Like a Stranger is on that as well.
Right.
It does make you wonder. You know, will you know? I'm sure this is probably not a Metropolitan Opera thing, but there's certainly 3 hours and 20 minutes of material that they could put into this and make it a huge, expansive experience musically if they wanted to.
There were rumors, who knows if it's true, that in his not in his later years, but I guess maybe in the 70s or 80s, that Pavarotti was exploring the possibility of doing a film, and then that didn't work for whatever reason. He wound up doing something called Yes, Giorgio, which was a tremendous flop,
right.
Unfortunately. But that would have been, because he would have been absolutely amazing in it.
All right.
There's 4 weeks left, so Michael, you should try to get up and see it.
Thank you.
I was just going to say it's running through December 1st,
yep.
And we have a link to the Goodspeed Opera House's production on our website, so check it out. Next up, we have Michael went to go see Betrayal on Broadway, so tell us, how is Mr. Craig and company?
Oh, well, I thought the acting was excellent, which is not a surprise. It's Daniel Craig, Rachel Weisz, and Rafe Spall, and also Stephen DeRosa in a one scene role as the waiter, and he's terrific in his one scene. But basically, it's the other three people. And in case some of our listeners don't know, this is a play by Harold Pinter, not a new play, about a love triangle, I guess. It's a husband and wife, and the wife winds up having an affair with a man who is a very good friend to both of them. And the gimmick here is that it's told backwards, like Merrily We Roll Along. The difference being, it's interesting in this play, you'll have a scene in a certain time, and then it moves backwards. But then you'll have like maybe two or three scenes in a row moving forward within that one time period. So it doesn't completely move backwards entirely. It goes back and then it goes forward like just a little bit, and then it goes back and kind of keeps doing that throughout the evening. But it's a very interesting structure. It has the same challenges that Merrily We Roll Along has, because you're seeing something at the end, and it's intriguing to figure out what's going on, but also sometimes can be maybe a little confusing, or if not confusing, just you're like wondering exactly what's happening. And also to see these people kind of at the end when everything is shot to hell basically, and everyone is really kind of sad, it's a challenge for the actors to bring us in because of that. And also, like Merrily, I found myself being engaged more and more in the play as it went along, which I guess is certainly better than the opposite, isn't it? but it is, it can be a little rough in the beginning, and especially also because it is Pinter, and this production directed by Mike Nichols does observe the famous Pinter pauses, which it's so interesting. I mean, they're one can see why they're absolutely necessary, and you certainly wouldn't want to do the plays without those pauses. But it's such a question of degree, and the timing can be so so difficult. I mean, it's like it comes down to sometimes like if you wait a half a second more than you need to for a pause, that, you know, that's not obviously so terrible. But if you keep doing that consistently, then it is going to seem like it's dragging a little bit, and it's a little jerky, and you just kind of want a little more of a flow. I did think that was a little bit of a problem in this production early on, but again, as it went on, it was less and less so. And you know, I certainly think that people who are going to see The Stars will not be disappointed, because not only is it their star presence, it's some really excellent acting by all three of them, again, as I said. And one thing that's interesting is that Rafe Spall in particular makes himself quite, I would say, kind of unattractive and doofy in this play. That's his that seems to be his and or Mike Nichols' interpretation of the role of Jerry. He's not some like really attractive guy when you think, oh well, of course she's having an affair with him, you know. And the fact that the man that she is cheating on is Daniel Craig, you know, who's generally considered, I think, you know, pretty much a sex symbol, a modern day sex symbol, makes it interesting. So it's not just lust that's going on here. It's something else entirely. And I think that's a good thing, because if it was just lust, then it would be less interesting, wouldn't it? But Pinter is not, you know, he would probably never write something that was that simplistic. So yes, I don't think it's amazing, and you know, but I think it's a very creditable production of a very tricky play.
By all accounts, this is a sold out production or a difficult ticket, right?
Oh yes, apparently it was. Yeah, from the get go. You know, but at least, you know, it's heartening when something like that happens. People may not be going for the right reasons, but once they get there, they're going to get a really good show in this case. So I think that's great.
All right. So next up on our agenda is After Midnight. Ken got a chance to see After Midnight at the Brooks. So Ken, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is Jack Vertel's evocation of the Duke Ellington era of the Cotton Club and other Harlem clubs of the 20s and 30s. The Cotton Club had several locations. There was a Midtown, there was a Harlem location and a Midtown location. This specifically focuses on the 20s, 30s, jazz age Duke Ellington era, when Duke Ellington was at his height, arranging for African American artists, performing for a white audience, and occasionally welcoming black stars and white stars to be sort of the guest stars of the floor shows. This played at Encores, City Center Encores, under the title Cotton Club Parade. I didn't see it then. Did you guys see it?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, and this, so they've rebranded it. It's called After Midnight. They've made some changes. They are keeping the Cotton Club tradition of having a guest star. Fantasia Barrino is the sort of headliner of this, and she comes out in very slinky, strapless gowns to sing down front a couple of times, and she dances with the boys as well. And I gather that Katie Lang is going to step in as a guest star in the coming year, probably not in a strapless gown. I'm sure she'll be very in a suit. You know, I'm sure she'll be very stylized and
classy.
Potentially have different material. Fantasia sounds amazing, and you know that's an amazing instrument. Really, the star of the show is the jazz at Lincoln Center All Stars. It's one of the great bands in New York, one of the great bands on Broadway right now, and it's no mistake. There's a reason they are slid down front. That bandstand comes down front. They're all on stage, and they come down two or three times, and it is seriously some of the most exciting musicianship I've seen. And the exit music is worth staying for. You know, it's right up there with, you know, the exit music for City of Angels. It's just incredibly muscular. And really exciting to hear music from that period written by white folks and written by black folks, and a lot of arcana and specialty numbers. I do want to mention a couple of knockout performances that are actually dance performances by two artists that I don't know, a guy named Julius Eiglide Chisholm and Virgil Lillo Gadsden, who do this loose-limbed, limber combination of hip-hop and breakdancing and period dance that is... it's the kind of thing you want to lift out of this show and put on another stage and have it run forever, because there's nothing like it. It just echoes the old days of vaudeville and specialty acts that we just don't really see anymore, unless you know, we're looking at NBC's talent shows. And there's just some amazing music in this show too. Harold Arlen and Ted Kohler's "I've Got the World on a String" and Kohler and Arlen's "Happy as the Day is Long." There's a number that I know from a musical called Jamaica called "Ain't It the Truth" by you guys know it from
Harold Arlen.
Arlen and Harburg, and that I sort of scratched my head trying to figure out why a song from the 50s was put in, but of course it was written for Cabin in the Sky in the 30s, so it's very period. It was cut from the film, apparently. That's the lyric that likens a coffin to laying horizontal in a telephone booth, which is just one of my favorite Harburg lyrics ever. but it's if you want a period and you want to go to a different time, it's certainly something to see. It also, they clearly want it to be refracted through the 21st century. So I'm not sure it's exact period. It's a take on the period. It's directed and choreographed by Warren Carlyle. But if you like jazz and if you like American pop and blues, you should see it.
All right, great. So next up on our agenda, Michael got a chance to see Becoming Dr. Ruth. Did I get that correct, Mike?
Yes, that's the title, yes.
So what did you think about it?
I really enjoyed it a lot. This is a one-person show about Dr. Ruth Westheimer, starring Deborah Jo Rupp, whom many people may know from her work on TV and that 70s show, in which she's fantastic. Or was fantastic, I should say, because it's not on anymore. I had high hopes for this play for two reasons. I think Dr. Ruth is a very charismatic character. And also, it was written by Marc St. Germain, who co-wrote Full Gallop with Mary Louise Wilson, that wonderful, wonderful one-woman show about Diana Vreeland. So I had high hopes for it, and they were fulfilled. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I'm embarrassed to say, as much as I enjoy Dr. Ruth, I really didn't know a lot about her, and I was really completely ignorant of her history, which includes some horrific Holocaust atrocities to her family, who were caught up and killed in the Holocaust. So that was very educational to me. In fact, I would say that a lot of the play really, really focuses on that and her coming of age, and it doesn't focus so much on the sex therapy. I mean, that's sort of like taken as a given, and it keeps, it's discussed several times, and she does talk about how she got into it and then how she became so famous for it initially on the radio. But the impersonation, if that's the word for it, is wonderful. Deborah Jo Rupp does a wonderful physical and vocal impersonation of her. The accent sounds really spot on to me, that adorable German accent. This is one of those interesting cases where I enjoyed it thoroughly. So did the fellow I was with. It seemed like the audience was really into it. I had, if anything, maybe minor quibbles with it, nothing major. And then I read a New York Times review that basically panned it and said that it trivialized Dr. Ruth and really did not like it at all. It was so interesting how people can have completely different reactions, especially in this case, because, I don't know how anything that deals so much with her horrific the horrific circumstances of her childhood and the Holocaust. I don't know how that could be seen as trivializing it in any way. So I hope that a lot of our listeners will get to see the show at the West Side Theater. I think it's very extremely entertaining and very, very well worthwhile. And if you do, I would be interested to hear how many, if any of you feel that it's trivializes the central character, because I completely disagree with that.
Michael, what's the frame of the show, or what's the world of it? How does she talk to us?
That's done very well. It starts out, she's getting ready to move from one Manhattan apartment to another, and there are boxes all about on the floor, and initially she's talking to someone, and then she says, oh, I have to go, I have company. And then she just kind of spots us and starts talking with us. And there might be, a brief moment of adjustment, but then after that, you completely accept it. And it is interesting to me to see how the various one-person shows have dealt with that. True, about Truman Capote, that dealt with it very well, and so did Full Gallop. And obviously, if they're going to be successful, that has to be handled with care. But I think it is done very well here.
Yeah. And Mark Saint Germain is also the author of Freud's Last Session, a two-person show.
Oh, yes, which I never got to see, but I heard such wonderful things about that.
Yeah, it's a great conversation and a great starter conversation about the world of Christianity and atheism and their opposing sides. But that also started, like this play started, at Barrington Stage Company, Massachusetts. So just a shout out to Resident Theater that does Feed off Broadway, and Deborah Jo Rupp has worked up there as well, and she's sort of a resident artist up at Barrington.
Great. Can I leap in here with some breaking news?
Sure.
I'm reading actually from Talkin' Broadway, all that chat. According to her Twitter page, Megan Hilty and Brian Gallagher got married last night.
Mazel tov.
At the Venetian in Las Vegas. So since Laura Benanti mentioned Megan earlier,
yeah,
I thought I should throw that in.
Well, maybe Laura was talking to us from the Venetian, having martinis. So, all right. So there is Becoming Dr. Ruth. It's at the West Side Theater. Looks to me like it's sort of an open-ended run. I don't see an ending date there, so try to get to see it.
I hope so.
All right. Ken got a chance to see the new John Kander show, The Landing. So, Ken, do you want to tell us a little bit about that show?
Sure. This is John Kander's new musical, of his first show. Composer John Kander, of course, of Cabaret and Zorba and Chicago and many, many others. It's his first show since the death of Fred Ebb, his longtime lyricist. He's writing this with a book writer and libretto and lyricist Greg Pierce, who wrote a play called Slow Girl at Lincoln Center, LCT3. And this is Kander sort of in miniature. It's three one-act musicals. It's at the Vineyard. It's sort of short story quality musicals, which I kind of always love, because if you don't like one, the next one comes along in about 15 minutes. I love one acts. I'm a big fan of one acts. I wish there were more one acts. So it was great to sort of see Kander use his muscles again. And rather than this being huge and brassy, it's a quiet thing. I mean, it's small. And
that song.
I know. I just fit that in for you, Michael. And it's four actors in multiple roles. It's Julia Murney, David Hyde Pierce, who is the uncle to playwright Greg Pierce, Frankie Sarach, he's a young kid, and Paul Anthony Stewart. And act one is a small little each one is kind of a little fable in a way. Act one is about a kid who's unhappy at school and unhappy at home, and sort of bonds with a carpenter in his home. And there's a sort of an O. Henry ending to this. There's an O. Henry ending to each one of these. I'm not sure it's an earthquake of an experience, but it does all make you sort of smile. The second act is a is called The Brick. It's about a woman obsessed with black and white movies. And she buys online a brick from the St. Valentine's Day Massacre from a bloody wall. That brick comes to life in the form of David Hyde Pierce. And there's a lot of pastiche and a lot of candor vamps and completely silly. And the third act is more serious-minded. It's about two gay men who are married who adopt a child. And it's about their relationship with him. He's a mysterious child. It's a fantasy of sorts, a very rueful rumination on parenthood and mortality with an O. Henry ending. So I can't really talk more about where they go. But, I don't know if this is a new phase for John Kander. He's in his 80s. I feel it feels a little bit like a transitional kind of musical, like he's either going to really change himself and be tiny and vest pocket like these are, or maybe this is just a transition and he's going to go on to continue writing what we consider the brassier, larger scale shows. That all has yet to be seen, but it's very exciting to be alive at a time when John Kander is still writing music.
Absolutely.
Hey, we had John Kander on, Michael, was it 2 years ago?
Yeah, quite some time ago. He's such an extraordinary man. He really and that's interesting. Your question there at the end, Ken. I mean, just recently, fairly recently, he's written shows in such completely different styles. The Scottsboro Boys, The Visit, and now this one. So I think he's always been. It's interesting. There's a certain type of music. Songs that Kander and Ebb wrote so well that they're really associated with that type. But from the beginning, they've written, very different styles. Zorba, what does that have to do with
jazz?
Yeah, and that's only one example. So I think that's one of the greatest things about Mr. Kander and is his versatility. And I hope he has many years ahead of us.
Funny sitting in the audience when those Kander vamps do return. Because it's his style in cabaret songs. I don't mean cabaret, but cabaret style songs. He has his famous vamps, and you can feel the audience relaxing into it, that they're with an old friend, and it's very exciting.
Can I ask you something quickly, Ken? I'm reading and hearing that some people apparently are very confounded by the show. I didn't see this, but it was someone said that Roma Torre, quote unquote, reviewed it on New York One, and her review was that she looked at the camera and scratched her head.
Yeah, I heard that too. Yeah.
Do you think it's confusing?
I don't think it's confusing. I think it's only confusing in the context of the stuff that he's written in the past, which is. Very clear, very narrative, very accessible, I guess. And these are more mysterious. These are the midsection is completely absurd, very broad strokes. And the third act is very mystical. And so they're confounded because it's not what he's done in the past, and people will always be confounded by that.
And would you say that basically what ties the three of them together is the O. Henry-ness of the endings, that kind of thing?
It's some people have said it's about loss and finding yourself. I had a harder time making connections between each, and I stopped looking for it.
Okay.
They are short stories.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to review the reviewer, but when every time I see Roma Torre do something, I scratch my head and stare at the screen.
Well, so. I don't know. I haven't watched New York One in a while, just because I don't get it on because I have very
Verizon.
But I agreed with her many times, and I think she can be very incisive. But I just I mean, I only single her out because someone mentioned that. But she's not apparently the only one. So I don't know what they can't figure out is how the three fit together, or if they're saying that they're confused by each individual show in and of itself. I'm curious to see it. I'm going this week, I think, or maybe next week. So I'm really interested to see it.
Well, and I also respect an institution like the Vineyard that it remains committed to its artists. That's where Scottsboro started. Yes. It's one of the places where Scottsboro started, and you know, candor is embraced there. And I think that there's something about being loyal to an artist as well. And like you said, James, if you can't review it, don't review it. Don't just scratch your head, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that is kind of kind of dismissive. Maybe she's going to do a follow up. I don't know.
So I wonder. I mean, off the top of my head, I don't really know the answer to this. Where is John Kander? Because the Scottsboro Boys is opening up on the West End, and so I wonder if he's over in London or if he's here.
Should we do Where in the World is John Kander?
Where in the world is John Kander? But
the work on this is certainly done. So my guess is if I were him, I'd be watching my London show. Yeah. It's a pretty fantastic show.
Well, as I think I mentioned last week, he was in New York because I was in the same room with him at this tribute to Sheldon Harnick down at the National Arts Club. So that was and it was not only those two, but also Stephen Schwartz and Hal Prince. It was quite the night. So that was amazing. And we're privileged to have someone like him, still doing it and still doing it so well.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see if the visit happens somewhere. You know, speaking of institutional theaters, you would think a place like Roundabout, which has also embraced Kander, would have the backing and the audience to support what is kind of an experimental musical.
Not to harp, but I think The Visit has not received a major production in New York because of a reviewer for the New York Times who saw it down at the Signature where I saw it and wrote a very negative review of it, which I think is completely unfounded and absolutely misses the entire point of the show. I think it's a modern classic. So is Scottsboro. But in that case, maybe it's easier to understand why it wasn't a huge success, because the subject matter is so very, very dark and very, very challenging. Not that The Visit isn't dark and challenging also, but it doesn't deal with race, which, you know, is such a, you know, will always be such an incredibly hot button issue.
Yes. And it may be my misperception of institutional theater that they can support with a safety net of subscribers that kind of show. Maybe that's sort of careless of me in a way to say that, because everything's expensive and everything costs, you know, but I would love to see it in New York one day, because I gather Skin of Our Teeth, they've lost the rights to.
No, I absolutely agree, Ken. And it is, I'm actually surprised that the Vineyard hasn't done The Visit. But also, I know it was actually announced at one point at the Public. And I cannot imagine what went wrong there, because, I mean, for heaven's sake, when you think of some of the things that are done at the Public, they aren't exactly commercial. I mean, to do The Visit with Cheetah Rivera, they probably, how badly could it have done?
And the truth is, The Visit is fairly commercial. It's not unclear what's happening.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
So, it'll be interesting to see how the West End audiences take to Scottsboro Boys, and we'll follow up with that in the next few weeks. Maybe we'll speak to some folks over there that are doing it. That'd be fun to do. All right. So Michael got a chance to see what is probably going to be the next huge hit in New York, which is called Disaster, a 1970s disaster movie musical by Seth Rudetsky and Jack Plotnick. So, Michael, tell us about this.
Yeah, maybe I can just mention it briefly now and then, because we are running a little long, and discuss further in the future, because I don't want to give short shrift.
See if we get maybe Seth on. Let's see if we get Seth.
Yes, that would be great, and I'm sure he'd probably love to do that. But let me say, this is one of the most hilarious, entertaining things I've seen in my entire life. It's a mash. It's called Disaster! A 70s disaster movie musical. And it's a send-up of all of those 70s disaster films, primarily, I would say, The Poseidon Adventure. But, you know, there are elements of Towering Inferno and all of the other ones, those fabulously over-the-top, you know, awful in many ways, but incredibly enjoyable films. Directed by Jack Plotnick, written by Seth Rudetsky and Jack Plotnick, with an amazing cast. It manages to work in just about every cheesy pop song from the 70s that was written. The friend I was with said, was there one song that they didn't work in? It's incredible. It seems like there are 100 songs in it, not necessarily all full length, but they're all touched upon. And the really cheesy ones, as well as some of the few, the relatively few that were really good. There's that song I always loved. I'm not sure what the title is. I'd really love to see you tonight. Is that it? Oh. I'm not talking about moving in.
Yeah.
I don't want to change. I always loved that song. but anyway, it's so funny. It's at the theater at St. Luke's, which I have to say, I've seen several shows there that have been really not good at all, and have seemed to be vanity productions. This is not one of those. It's got an amazing cast. John Tracy Egan, Mary Testa, Jennifer Simard, Michelle Ragusa, blah, 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 blah. I'd love to talk about it more in the future, but please put it on your radar. The full price tickets begin at $39.50, and I am going to tell you, this is going to be one of the best expenditures for entertainment that you will ever have. The audience was just rolling and screaming in laughter. People had to continually wait had to pause before delivering their next lines because people were just loving it so much. And it's a small theater, I should say. So no matter the worst seat that you could possibly get for your $39.50 is not going to be bad at all. I'm going to make this show. As I said to someone, I'm going to promote this as if I had something to do with it because it's absolutely delightful and incredibly hilarious.
So I did a quick search, and I'd really love to see you tonight.
Yes.
And it comes up on Google with the two different writers. One of the writers is Barry Manilow. Is it possible that Barry wrote this?
I did not know that.
Well, it could be that the Google is wrong because it's got Dan and John Ford Coley is also the writers. So
yeah, that sounds right.
Sounds right.
I think maybe you'd be sometimes you when I Google
Barry
things like
it?
That. Yeah, it comes up with the artist name and they confuse it. But I think that other one is correct. And I think that's – I wasn't even sure that was the title, but I guess it is. But this also has Hooked on a Feeling. Yeah. It has – you know what it doesn't have? It doesn't have a single one of the disaster movie themes. I don't know if they couldn't get the rights or they just thought it was too obvious, but it doesn't have The Morning After. I don't think it had The Morning After. Maybe it had like a measure of it because I'm telling you, there are like 100 songs sampled in it at least. It's just incredible.
Great. And it's at St. Luke's Theater.
On
46th. And it's got a strange schedule. So check out their website for the for the schedule. I mean, they're kind of like Monday and Tuesday at 7:30, Wednesday at 2:30, and then Friday at 8 p.m.
Yes, because they have yeah. several other shows still running there.
Yeah.
As I said, but this one, I'm telling you, this is worth your while. It's just great.
Might be one of those things that people are, if they find themselves in this New York City on a Saturday afternoon and said, oh, let's go see this thing tonight. They're not going to see it.
This show is everything that Mamma Mia wanted to be and should have been. It's 800 million times more entertaining and funnier than Mamma Mia. And I honestly think that this show could come to Broadway. It's screamingly funny. It's like, I mean, the producers wasn't funnier than this. It's just hilarious.
Well, now that you've brought up Mamma Mia, I have to wrap up the show for the day. Yes. So.
Yes, that would be.
All right. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to it in iTunes. You can listen to it on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device that will automatically stream This Week on Broadway to your device. We also get played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And information to contact Ken or Michael or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So on behalf of Kenneth Jones and Michael Portantiere, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Peppa, are you there? Are you there? Are you okay or not there? But we need to talk. My stomach's aching like I swallowed some enormous rock. I'm at the phone booth on the corner and I've only got a minute cause I'm running out of change cause I've been lending all my money to Malik. God knows with men I'm not exactly on a lucky streak, but this one really is a mess. I think I'm gonna freak. I know you say I'm an alarmist, but I'm not. Remember, there's that time I thought I saw a spider. You said, nah, it's a raisin, but it suddenly started moving and it crawled over and bit me on the toe. So if you're gonna stand in judgment, that's how much you know. It's a good thing I didn't eat it, but I never would have ate it, cause I never did like raisins, so why would there be a raisin on the floor?